Hi everyone, I'm Lula.
And I'm Jude.
And welcome back to Just Friends.
This one's crazy.
Today I'm actually excited.
I'm so excited.
Authentic cheer. Okay, we have a super special guest.
Yes, and I'm going to do the intro, but also I hope you all are actually enjoying your spring break because last episode, or whatever, two episodes ago, I did sound like an asshole, and I acknowledge, and I'm sorry.
Thank you. Eva. Apology, reparations on air. Okay.
Yeah, there you go.
Moving forward.
Okay, this week's guest has no idea how long we've secretly wanted him to join us on the podcast. He's not only a listener of the pod and a friendly face on campus, but he is outright the funniest person I've ever had the pleasure of interacting with. Ben Jenkins is a senior at Yale majoring in film and media studies. He's in not one, but two comedy groups, Red Hot Poker and The VQ, and performs solo stand-up comedy shows on campus. His comedy comes from a clever, chaotic, and authentic place. Ben, thank you so much for joining us and welcome to the pod.
Wow, thank you so much for having me, and thank you for that introduction. I'm touched.
Was Jude
Seriously,
correct? Was Jude
you
correct?
Flattered at me.
Did we leave anything out?
Well, no, I don't think so. And you gave me so much. I'm so humbled.
Okay, great. For our listeners who maybe are not current Yale students and don't know the campus celebrity that you are, can you tell us a little bit about yourself? I'm like, where are you from? How are you feeling today? Maybe not an elevator pitch, but like, you know,
like how your heart is.
Okay.
How about that?
Okay.
We like to start there.
Well, my heart is pure, of course, of course. And I only ever have good intentions. But where am I coming from today? Well, yesterday was my birthday, so I'm in a really grounded place in terms of the love I've received from all the people I care about. And additionally, the self-love. I feel like birthdays is always like an annual just check-in. And I don't know how everybody feels about this, but I kind of like the birthday, the photo culture that has emerged around birthdays where your friends come forward with the most iconic, heartwarming, chaotic photos, whatever, superlative photos, or whatever photos they look best in, but that's still a superlative. And it's amazing to look at those charged photos because it's like, period, we did that. That was really a year, huh? Or that was really, or if it was many years ago, like, look how far we've come. Like, there's just so much reflection that I am a really sensual, so what is the word? Sensory? No. But I just get, I'm very sentimental, or like,
there we go.
My senses get extremely activated by art and especially photography between like close personal relationships. Mm. And so my birthday just feels like a check-in of just like, what does it mean to be Ben Jenkins now compared to what it meant a year ago? And every year my birthday somehow ends up being like that. But you didn't ask me about my birthday at all, so please excuse
me. I have a question, though, Ben. What does it mean to be Ben Jenkins today?
Well, first of all, it means to share a birthday with Jude, Zach. So let me shout it out for all the listeners. Don't be afraid to send him an Atticus latte. But what does it mean to be Ben Jenkins now? Well, you know what? It's really meaning something different than it has meant throughout my time at school, because I really feel like I am a student. Like, I actually am a future graduate of this university. So that has not really been the biggest thing in my life of feeling like I did it. Like, Yale is like, I'm Yale. Like, I did Yale, you know? I've never really felt like it until I think like this fall. I was like, okay, I can stop trying to figure out if I belong here or how I can belong here, and just accept all of the ways of belonging that I've already created and let them embrace me before I'm gone. So what it means to be Ben Jenkins, honestly, is to like be embraced, I think, by all of the things that I've put effort into in the last couple of years to become a part of. And I think that goes between like, you know, my comedy groups and even like my curricular work. Not that I even do readings or anything like that. I'm not a good curricular worker. I'm not a good student per se, but like a little bit, I'm feeling like a back rub from like all of the work I've put in terms of my major and, you know, shit like that. Like the distributional requirements, they're lifting me up and everything is carrying me toward commencement. So I feel like what it really means to be Ben Jenkins right now is to be on the precipice of graduation into a world of uncertainty where those forms of embrace and stability and care and community might not persist. I mean, a lot of them won't be there for mm-hmm. me next year because they're parts of this school and I'm leaving this community. But the biggest thing I'm thinking about and that I was thinking about yesterday is like, how can I carry what it feels like to be supported by all of these people and by all of the work that I've done and by all of the communities I'm a part of into the uncertainty of graduation when I don't necessarily have them available to me in the same way. Mm. Just like, how can I hold on to like, I feel loved right now and I feel happy and I feel comfortable. And that has not always been the case, especially not at Yale. But now that I have that, it's given me the room to be like, what do I want out of life? Like, what do I dream of doing? And I don't want to go into the world and be faced with uncertainty and lose my dreams and go work at Bain or something. You know, mm-hmm. like, not that I could even get that job. Like, I really could not. And I might be one of the only idiots who didn't pursue that at Yale, but alas.
Okay, let's talk about that.
Okay.
So Jude and I talked about, I think like, so we started the pod last November. Mm-hmm. Shout out to Sophomore Slump. And so much of the content.
What is Sophomore Slump?
Okay.
Like you just, like you have time to like do your project. Like
no,
announce
like
yourself
that.
To the Yale community.
No, it's like.
It's like, why
everyone's,
am I here?
Yeah, everyone's like not happy at Yale, I think.
I think that's just like, yeah, it's like, ugh.
Well, I think it's a college
thing.
Yeah,
I was going to say, I think it's also like a high school thing. I think sophomore year is just like, why? Like it's just a filler year.
Wait, did you not experience like a bad time sophomore year?
Well, I took a gap year between freshman year and sophomore year because of COVID, but I really resonate with what you're saying. Like if I had gone straight from freshman year into sophomore year, when I was done with freshman year, which actually ended literally on this day 4 years ago because it was COVID and we never ended up coming back, I was so like, uh-oh. Like freshman year did not give what I expected as a high schooler. Like when I signed up to come to Yale, I did not expect to be like a random loser. And why is that what I feel like, you know, like, bro, I literally thought getting into Yale was like, you're done. You're cooked. Yep. You're literally fully cooked.
Yep.
Great job. You ate down with your private school education and you delivered. And now you go to, yeah, I'm sure it doesn't just apply to private school, but I grew up going to this, right, for high school, I went to this private school in New York City. And the New York City private school culture is very, like, nobody talks about it, but everybody is desperate to get in somewhere hoity-toity. And of course, everybody does because everybody's, like, either super connected and wealthy or legacies. And it's like, everybody pretends like, you know, well, I didn't accept a position at Harvard as an undergraduate, you know, and that was really something where I was a little bit flailing in high school. And I was like, bitch, I'm talented. Like, I need to prove myself to everybody around me, to everything going on. And now that I got into Yale, boom, done. I proved it. I'm amazing. Please respect me as such. And then when I got to Yale and nobody was like, oh my God, Ben Jenkins, you got into Yale. Of course, nobody's going to say that here. I was like, so what now?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think that's the direct. I think that actually explains really well why the sophomore slump occurs, or at least out of what I experienced, because I was like, I don't know. First of all, freshman year, everyone needs to go to therapy. Second of all, you end freshman year like, really unclear, at least me, socially, what academic path, changed my major 4 times already, don't like any of the clubs that I'm in, didn't get into clubs that I wanted to be in, etc. So I think then sophomore year, we are the, like, whatever age group that went straight from high school into college for the most part and didn't gap. And I actually think a gap between freshman and sophomore year is an interesting idea that people should think about. Because
I was thinking about this. Yeah. Sorry.
Wait,
oh, sorry.
No, no, no. Go.
God,
I
don't know
hear.
The decorum here.
I want to hear.
Honey, it's your podcast. I just am droning on.
No,
I have nothing
hear
original
your takes.
To say. But I was thinking about this because, like, my brother, he's a junior in high school now. And I'm thinking like, oh my God, he needs to gap. Like, he needs to just go out and experience life before he comes to school so that he realizes, like, this is a microcosm and you're supposed to come here with goals and this school is supposed to beat you around and force you to reckon with those goals and figure out a new way you want to define yourself and live your life and build a lifestyle that you can sustain, hopefully post-grad or whatever. I mean, I feel like personally that's what happened to me. I built a self-worth and a lifestyle and an approach to learning and friendship and yada, yada, yada that makes me at least feel at this point like that taught me a lot that I didn't know coming out of high school. And I think I'm ready to go out into the world now. But the reason I think I'm skeptical is just what we talked about. Like, if you gap between freshman year and sophomore year, you've already had to experience college. And that year gives you the time to reckon with like everything college was compared to your expectations of it. My fear with just gapping after high school before freshman year is like, well, you haven't been exposed to college yet, so how can you grapple with the ways it's going to fail your expectations?
Mm. Okay, why did you phrase it like you feel like it's stupid to not apply to Bain? For example.
Just because, I mean, let's talk about the excellent sheep. Come on, because I think I really believe that I see it at Yale where it's implied. All of this is really implied by the environment. But the implication, I think, is that if you go to Bain, you can maintain the right pathness without making any sort of sacrificial decisions. And I think that's why Bain is extremely attractive. And I think that's why all the hedge funds and big banks are extremely attractive. I think finance, consulting, medicine, and law, those are the big 4 points of the Excellent Sheep book. And I would just say, like, I think we need more doctors. Like, goddamn, have you guys gone to Yale Health? They literally will not treat you. They will literally misdiagnose
you. They make you very much worse.
Yeah, no, we need good doctors. So I don't really resent anybody going into medicine at all. But I think the point of the argument of the Excellent Sheep is just that structurally, the university caters to those careers. Yeah. And because there is so much less of a clear path for any other careers. And I don't think that's necessarily the university's fault. I mean, like, what are they going to do? Teach you how to be a singer-songwriter? You got to have talent. Right. You got to have ambition for a lot of those careers. But because in the university, there's so many official pathways and people are so used to like institutional excellence and like defining themselves as excellent parts of bigger institutions, it's quite easy to look at law, medicine, consulting, and finance and say, look at these big institutions with clear paths of success. I'll go into them and they will give me power and resume credentialism that I can then transition later on if I need to into passion and into what I actually want to be doing. So I think it just defers that sort of risky decision-making. And it doesn't even have to be a decision. For example, like, God, I've been doing comedy for so long, but like, I often think like, there are so many life paths that would be absolutely epic and potentially even better than being like a comedian. And from being a comedian at the height of success or being a comedian at the bottom of success. Of course, it's probably more comfortable at the top, but.
What are some of those lifestyles and careers that you admire?
Well, listen, I really have been getting into printmaking, okay?
We talked about this on the street, Ben.
Okay, exactly.
Wait,
there you go.
Your soliloquy.
Because Lula actually came through. Wait, what is the soliloquy? Is this like a trope you guys have
no,
on the pod?
Your soliloquy about this book. And
okay, so I'm going to go off because I was with my improv group. We were in Charleston performing. We were on tour, as they call it, at Yale. but really, it's just a bunch of kids in a house performing improv for senior citizens. But we were in Charleston, and I got a package delivered. It was like a book that I had to get like on like Backwater eBay. You know, like those other websites that it's like people are selling personal goods, but it's not even eBay. It's like, yes. Damn, Backwater internet. So I was on one of those websites. I found this book. It's a catalog raisonné, which I think in art history means a catalog of all of the works of an artist and not just the significant works, not just the works that are in the MoMA or whatever. So I got this book, Catalog Raisonné, of Andy Warhol's prints, because he's infamous for screen printing. I mean, think of any famous Warhol work, it's screen printed. Mm-hmm. And I was getting into screen printing. I love Warhol's work. I know people are like, you have no taste. No, he's smart. See me after. We'll talk. Like, there's so much about Warhol's work that's responding to like media and the media establishment at the time, celebrity. Like, it's so important. It's so important to everything that I think we have as a media and cultural landscape now. Anyway, got into screen printing. Voila, there's one right here. Woo! And printmaking is really exciting to me as an analog way to express any sort of like artistic intuition without necessarily needing what I believe to be important technical skills, like how to draw or how to paint. Because when I draw and paint, it looks like somebody got way too drunk at Paint and Sip, you know, like it actually, and the drawings, like I literally draw stick figures, like of my best friends and God. And anytime I draw and it's somebody who is of a, who is a non-white person, the drawings are so bad that it's actually threatening me as a potential racist man if I let these drawings come out. So God, I'm rambling. All this to say, the most important subject to me in printmaking, and this the most important subject to me in my life, really, is the relationships I have and the friendships I have. So yeah, basically, I find that printmaking is sort of a medium in which I can express some of these relational dynamics that I feel and that I don't even really understand, but that I can see basically in the prints and that I can then also share with other people. So that's something to me that's amazing and rich and so emotionally fulfilling that has nothing to do with comedy and nothing to do with telling jokes, but also allows me to engage my sense of humor because my sense of humor is always born out of context and relationship. So that's just a perfect example. Like, you know, maybe I could be a printmaker, but then again, printmaking and being a comedian, those don't turn the lights on in the early years.
They're not, like, they're not bait.
They're not stable careers in any sense. This is not like going to work at Blackstone and or Jane Street. If I was a Jane Street quant making upwards of $300,000 my first year out of college, honey, I would drive around Manhattan in a Porsche every day. But like that to me feels really stable and like immediately fulfilling. And I think I'm really excited about like culture and celebration and iconography. Like, what do people care about? And what's iconic and what's fun? Like, what is literally fun? And that's why I joke, like, if I had this Jane Street job, the only appeal to me would be the stability and the money. And if I had that, I'd drive around in a Porsche and go to every party. That's what's important to me, is like being a part of a world that's fun and that people are meeting new people and connecting across boundaries. And I realized that like the institutional stability actually forces you to turn that off. Being working at a firm like that and being in a really stable career where you're sort of expected to come in every day. If you don't come in on Saturday, don't even think about coming in on Sunday. It's that level of like intense work ethic, putting this boring exploitative work first. Sorry, but I don't know enough to really like shoot and point guns at the financial institutions, but like at the very least, we can all agree they might not be the best thing for everyone in the American economy. And if you don't agree with that, just look at 2008. Now, I don't really, I'm no financial historian, but I think we can all agree the financial system is not the mecca, be all end all of human progress and of economic progress. And it forces compliance, really. It forces people to be really compliant and really of service, basically 7 days a week, to markets and to bosses and to people who expect you to behave a certain way. And I think anything amazing comes out of non-compliance and the space of having an internal resistance to the way things are and trying to express that and change the world a bit to look more like how it should look in your heart.
Yeah.
Okay. So there's my soliloquy.
Thank
Boom.
You. See, I knew you would deliver. So did you tell Ben like every single topic we wanted to talk about? Because you literally just hit all of them. So thank you.
Oh God, I had no idea. I literally had no idea.
No, I was like, he's dropping buzzword relationship.
Okay,
wait.
Where do you want to go back? There's so much there.
I have things to go back to. Yeah, so I just heard this argument that was like, I think it was on TikTok. It was TikTok or a podcast. And it was this woman being like, she was some creative artist, whatever. And she was like, if you want to pursue art, what, like in a real, like everyday, like this is my job thing, she was like, you cannot have a job that demands your energy, like in a focused way. And she wasn't talking about like going to work. She was like, obviously everyone needs to turn the lights on, but she was just like, if you have a job that is like you're saying, literally demanding like 7 days a week or whatever. And I don't know if you feel this way. I feel this way though, but I'm like, if I went into it and I was like, yes, the stability would be amazing. Honestly, Yale sets me up better to get a job like that than to pursue something I'm actually interested in. But I tell myself this whole narrative that's like, I could go into work 7 days a week, da da da, do my passions after hours. This woman was like, fuck no, stupid. Like, she was like, you're literally going to be so drained. And I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts on that, because I think it's so sadly unrealistic to be like, I could be giving the energy that I want to be giving to art and creating something, whether it's like comedy or screen printing or whatever for you, while working a job that provides stability in such a like significant way.
My first thought about that is that everybody's got to work. And I just think about like the kind of careers that are more traditional for like starving artists, like service jobs. And I wonder, like, what's the difference then between like a service job or like working at here's the example I'm thinking of. What's the difference between working at a coffee shop and working at a bank? And the biggest thing I can think about both of them is something that an artist always has to do, which is bear witness. So if you're at a bank, you're bearing witness to the culture of the bank, to how the bank works. And there's always something fruitful everywhere. There is always a story to be told. There's always interpersonal dynamics that have weird and intricate networks. There's always something to bear witness to, no matter where you go on earth. That being said, if you don't have time to sort of like transcribe or process or step outside of the context that you've witnessed, it's hard to be the witness for it and to tell those stories or whatever. So I'm just thinking about like people who work at banks and then go and write, you know, billions. And I don't know if the writer used to work at a bank, but like there's a lot of media about banks and what it would be like to work at a bank. So that's the part where I do think like an artist can go there and bear witness and then step outside of it and probably transition into art. But I think you have to also, I think you're really right. Some jobs that are more flexible with hours or where you just have the opportunity to come or where it doesn't drain you in, well, God, I mean, a coffee shop is probably just as draining as working at a bank.
That's where
I don't
my
really,
head went too.
I don't buy this argument that people who work at a bank are all like Nobel Prize level, you know, brainiacs. I believe they're smart and I believe that they go through, you know, these like really well respected institutions and it takes some level of intelligence to get in, but to those schools. But I don't think anybody at a bank is necessarily 1 million times smarter than anybody working at the coffee shop downstairs.
I don't think that either. But I do think there's something to that point with flexibility and constraints. Like when you commit to like a high up job on that's like a bank job, you're committing to like being on call every single day to like an extreme level. And you're expected to stay later than you actually are told. And you're expected to come on the weekends. And like there's real level of like kind of rigidity in the structure of the system. I think that if you're choosing a service job, yes, there's still structure, but if you don't show up, like, or you have to leave because you have a creative idea or you want to write something down, that's just more accepted in that culture, I think. I think that it's like definitely just as draining. I mean, I probably in many ways, probably more draining. You're standing on your feet all day. Like service jobs are so, so difficult, but I think there's a little bit more flexibility within like the structure and like you aren't expected to work on days that you aren't supposed to work on or like when you're off the clock, you're off the clock. You don't have to be responding to emails.
Yeah. I mean, I completely agree with that. And, you know, I can only speak for myself. I'm sure there's a lot of people out there who love finance, my parents included. I mean, they like that job. They like thinking like that. And I know there's a lot of people that like thinking like that. So maybe for them, working until 2 a.m. and delivering slide decks and, you know, whatever, is their personal growth and personal fulfillment. I don't want to pretend like those two things can't go together. But just for me, I couldn't really imagine with all of the creative things that I'm passionate about and all of the relationships I have, I couldn't imagine spending 14 hours a day being of service to a hierarchy that doesn't really show me much about myself as much as it shows about itself and the profits I can get from it. It doesn't teach me about the sort of personal growth profits that I need, because the personal growth I'm looking for is not being an amazing investor. It's being a funny person. It's being a really caring and present person in all the relationships I'm with. It's making art that can imbue or that is imbued with those kind of relationship dynamics and the lessons I've learned from all of my experiences, those are the things that fulfill me. And I secretly think those are the things that fulfill a lot of people who get misled. And that's what I really am thinking about. It's like, I have no judgments as like a wealthy white person from New York whose parents worked in finance against anyone from a non-financially secure background going into this institution where you're guaranteed to be given a financial secure background that can then help your family generations above and below. That I have no judgments on. I don't even have moral qualms with that. I don't even think about that because that is so not my place. But what I think about often is people who come from a position of financial security and why there is a myth of insecurity that is brought on by graduation. And I think that has a lot to do with the anxiety of being an excellent sheep and feeling like I need to know where I'm going next. I need a stable career path. I need to keep beating the system. You know, I grew up financially comfortable, but every day I got to school and I felt like I needed to compete. So I'm not saying like, you know, there isn't an arms race and there isn't a competition. School is an arms race, especially like private schools in New York. It's just about who can outcompete who. And often money is what fuels the different arms. And I'm talking about tutors and SAT prep and paying for extracurriculars, you know, paying to have your kids, you know, go to Thailand and experience rustic pathways there or yada, yada, yada. But I'm just really skeptical of people whose goal is financial and the accumulation of personal wealth when they had financial security. Yeah. And that gets to what I really believe exists, which is a myth of enough. We don't really teach people how to have a self-worth. So there's broken people everywhere from the highest income to the lowest because people don't know what it means to be enough, let alone have enough. And I've been guilty of this many times where I end up with like, what, 50 t-shirts. How many fucking days are there even in a year? I'm never going to wear all those shirts. Like you need to be able to recognize a point of accumulation that is enough. And from there, you can get more happiness only by working on yourself. There's a threshold at which no more amount of financial accumulation will gain you happiness. Yep. And so it's people who've already met that threshold who are continuing to seek financial gain, often at the expense of others, that I'm very skeptical of.
That God. I just think it's scary, though. Like, I think I agree with everything you just said. Like, I think it's all well said. But like, I think that like, it's easier to go and find the money and follow the path than like look inwards and be like, okay, well, what doesn't feel so good? What is money not solving? Because waking up and going on the next step is easier, just frankly.
Mic drop.
We're gonna shift a little bit, but I kind of want to let Ben decide which way route we go.
Okay, fine.
Is that fine?
Yeah.
Okay, Ben.
If that's fine
with
Ben. We
have two different routes we want to go, and we probably only have time to like touch one. Maybe we can briefly talk about both. But one is we want to talk about relationships and love, specifically on Yale campus. And the other one we want to talk about is being unfiltered.
Oof.
They
juicy.
Can intersect.
They
interwoven. They're very intersectional.
Yeah.
Because I think, well, it goes to everything we're talking about. I don't know. I think you can repel by being too unfiltered. I think, I don't know. Have you ever gone somewhere and somebody is just saying absolutely crazy shit? And it's like, I don't really want to be associated with them because what the fuck are they saying? And I don't want them to drag this.
At least once a month. Like, genuinely.
At least once a month. Yes. And of course, I wonder and often expect that that is how people feel about me in certain ways. And maybe it's not so deep. Like, you know, for example, I don't really want to be seen with anybody who agrees that abortion should be repealed. But they might not want to be seen with me because my, you know, irreverent comments about why I don't want to work at a bank are sort of off-putting and uncomfortable to them or challenge what they're expecting out of life and what maybe their friends are expecting. So I think being unfiltered is like, well, it's more fun. Just say what you mean. It's much, it gets you where you want to go because if you're unfiltered and people share your opinion, then that's how you make a friend. And you can make a friend in 10 seconds with a true opinion. And I also think that like, it just goes back to what I'm saying about compliance. Being authentically opinionated and compliance cannot go together in a perfect intersection. There needs to always be room for non-compliance in an opinion because the truth will never be 100% legible and compliant with the status quo. And this is like a Bertolt Brecht essay from the 1930s that he wrote in Denmark after he was fleeing the Third Reich. So, like, I'm not the first person to say that, but I think that, like, of course, the truth is only so true as its context and only so true as its resistance to that context. So that's what I think about being irreverent or unfiltered.
Okay, I have multiple follow-ups.
You have a follow-up. I'm just going to comment, but then you can ask the follow-up question.
You comment,
I was
too.
Just, like, reflecting on, like, your comment about the bank as well and, like, how what's fulfilling is being yourself and following your gut in a lot of ways. And, like, whether that be following stand-up, pursuing stand-up, or maybe print, like, printmaking, right? But, like, yes. There's something about, like, being in a system like Yale, which is pretty, like, don't share your opinions. Like, follow the excellent sheep thought, whether it's both career path or political beliefs or whatever it is. It's just, like, there's one right answer. And you challenge it. You push it. You say what is your heart thinking. Wait, you say what your heart
what
is feeling.
What your heart is.
There we go.
Okay.
And I don't know. I just respect that a lot. And I think it does drop.
Well, thank you. I'm wondering what example you're really drawing on, because I sometimes feel like, you know, I'm just trying to get my degree. And sometimes that requires me to shut up and work and just do the work. And I also think that that is not also in contest with being unfiltered. Like, everybody at Yale gets the work done. That's how we all still are students here, because, you know, we're putting it up to a certain degree. We're doing enough to be continually offered the opportunity to enroll. But, yeah, I'm just wondering, too, like, what about me is because if you think I'm unfiltered, I'm just speaking to you guys personally, then the only reason I know you is because I have mutual friends and we know each other from the context of being social. So you guys don't really know me from a context in which my unfilteredness has been a direct challenge to whatever the dominant social order is and whatever the cool people are and whatever. Like, we know each other because you think I'm cool and I think you're cool. But so in that context, my unfilteredness has never threatened my social standing. So that's why I'm just wondering,
and
what examples of, like, my unfilteredness.
That's a great question. And that word might not be actually even the right word in my head. You may have a different answer, but
it goes into what my follow-up question.
Do you want to go do your follow-up question? Or, yeah, you can do your follow-up question.
Okay. My follow-up question had to do with social media, because I think I don't know when I think of you, I think of someone who's unfiltered. Sorry, I'm like, it's interesting, like, telling you how I think about you. That's an interesting task. I don't think when I'm like, oh, I'm thinking of Ben, there's Ben on the street, I'm not like, we're going to have an outlandish conversation. I'm like, it's going to be very immediately authentic, which is, like, I super appreciate and I feel like is rare. The reason I said even the word soliloquy, and I was like, oh, when I saw you on the street. Normally, if I see someone on the street, especially who I know through a mutual friend, like you said, we will either say, how are you, good, or not interact.
Yep.
And I learned about, like, 10 minutes of your interest in Warhol and this specific printmaking book, which I really appreciate. The reason I think about the social media thing is because I think before I even, like, knew you or had any substantial conversations with you, I would see your very hysterical social media presence. And that, to me, is more when I think the word unfiltered comes in. Because I think social media is very filtered, largely.
Yeah.
And even that, it's authentic. It's just like you just posting your, like, yourself.
That's the through line.
Yes. My only caveat to that, that would be, how authentic can social media ever really get?
Yeah.
And I think that what I find about my relationship with my social media is I think I try to operate with that. In high school, I was very, like, uncomfortable with all the different ways. I was like, I'm also a buffoon, like, just, and I'm an attention seeker too. I think that's why I express all of these different opinions on social media instead of to my journal, you know, like, why, what about me is making me want to, like, say all this publicly? But what really makes me want to say all this publicly is just the relationships I have with, like, everybody through social media of just like laughing at the things I say or responding or resonating with the things I say. I love that people are touched because there's nothing I love more than making other people laugh. Like that's truly my dream. But, and social media is kind of a way to do that. And I think maybe what you're getting at is that like oftentimes my engagement with social media is never really, it's ironic that you would call it authentic because I think what I'm exploiting most is sort of like the inauthenticity of social media. Like I'm not going to post, you know, I don't often post something just because I think it looks really good and it looks so aesthetic and whatever, or I don't know. I mean,
no, that's exactly what I was getting at.
What good and you know, who knows what the correct thing to do on social media is. I don't think there are any rules, but I think there are certain norms that people abide by. And to be honest, I wish I could follow those norms. I think like growing up, I was always just like, especially in high school, I was like, God, like where do I need to go to like take this selfie? Or like, how do I EGOT with this picture by like, what do I need to go to the gym? Do I need to yada, yada, yada? Uh-huh. Like, how can I perform excellent social media behavior? And I struggled so much that I kind of just admitted defeat and sort of have just I want to just be funny. I want to just be funny. And that's why sometimes like I've been resistant to it for a while, but now I'm leaning into create mode. Like sometimes I have no
that's
selfie
exactly
to take,
what I was
just
referencing.
Something to say.
Yeah.
Like sometimes I'm just like, yada, na, 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 because I don't really want to take a selfie. I just noticed something hilarious. And I'm like, don't you guys agree that this is fucking crazy? Let me share it out. But then of course, another part of my social media is when I bought 10,000 followers, because that was something I just wanted to experience what it would look like if my profile had that. And that's of course tickling my ego. But also at the same time, I thought about it and I was like, I almost don't care that it's so fake, because isn't this all like whatever? Like,
I
really
think,
just the whole point of social media is to show other people like, how do you see yourself? And I think it's hilarious to tell other people I see myself with 10,000 followers. And the reality is all those followers are Russian bots. So that's just me. That's just me, babe.
I think that's exactly what I was trying to get at.
That's also, what I'm getting at is there's just, and I think it's the most compelling part of you. And like the reason I've wanted to have a conversation with you on the pod for so long is that like, since day one, it's like, maybe I don't actually know who like the Ben Jenkins is, because you're always changing.
Yeah.
And like, we haven't had like deep, deep, deep conversations, but there's a level of like, oh, like this person is actually being a human. They're not putting up this facade that's like there's a craziness and a chaoticness to you that like is endearing and is authentic. Well, and like, that's what I love.
It's because behind that profile, behind that webpage, and I like to say avatar, like it literally is my avatar. It's not a real, you know what I mean? Like I step into it and I perform with it. I'm talking about avatar, like the movie, I know that also that the word avatar is generally applicable, but it's literally like my avatar. Like I step into it and I go into the world of social media. God, this is a terrible metaphor because of the like colonial relationship to the Navi people, but God, what is the real tea is this. There is a human being on the other side of that profile struggling to figure out how to perform the correct version of Instagram behavior. And so I kind of embrace the bomb, as they say. Like, I don't know how to be an Insta baddie, an Insta gay. So I can't do that. So I'll just do what I can and just let it go.
Do you feel that?
Because I want the attention
too,
even if I can't get like, when people like my stuff, I imagine that if I was an Insta gay and like every picture was like shirtless, six pack, like me with a bunch of other gay people, every like would be like, I want to fuck you. I want to fuck you so bad. I want to fuck you so bad. Whereas for me, like, I just don't feel like that is this. First of all, I don't feel like an Insta gay. I don't feel like I look like that. I don't feel like I am on that level of riz, like all of that. So when I post, I literally just want to be like, then can you just give me a laugh? I know nobody wants to fuck me, but just give me a laugh. And that, of course, goes back to what they say about comedians, which is that all comedians have some sort of internal flaw about their relationship to themselves that creates room for comedy. And for me, I think it is the relationship between my social self and my real self. And I mean social self in terms of like romantic and sexual self, as well as like social self in all different ways, like as my parents' son, as a graduate of my high school, as a Yale student, as a member of my improv group, as a friend of all these different people. I struggle all the time with just how to perform that social self. And so Instagram is kind of just a little playground where I can get into the mess of that struggle. And I think that's the fundamental fundamental struggle that I have that has created my sense of humor is the gap that I feel between my social self constantly and my internal self. And of course that gap ebbs and flows and it's very sort of different moments. Sometimes the gap is too wide that I don't find it funny. I find it off-putting and I find it like, I'm going to stay in bed today and I don't want to go out and interact with people because, oh God, like the version of me that they see is not who I want to be. Mm-hmm. And then at other times I'm like, humor usually is the way out where I'm always just like, that is not me. The person you want me to be, I cannot be. Mm-hmm. Sorry, ho. And then I post a little joke.
Okay, so I have then my question for you, which is that at the beginning of this podcast, you said that you felt that this year you're feeling embraced by, and you went on a rant of different social groupings and social institutions that you feel accepted
by. Like, here's where dude uses your words against
you. Do you feel less funny because of that? Do you feel scary? Like, how does being accepted and being loved by the people and being you, truly you, affect your comedy?
Great question. Great, great question. Honestly, it just depends. I mean, with improv and sketch, really, those are two spaces where it's like everybody around me is so funny that we're just riffing jokes with each other. And I find that my humor, even if I had no sense of humor, I would probably gain one just by, you know, osmosis with the people around me. But in terms of my personal comedy, it's actually about balance. It's not binary in any sense where it's not like if I'm loved, I can't be funny because now I'm accepted. Humor, first of all, is a personal relationship. Most of all, it's like about my acceptance in any social situation and how much I can love my social self versus my real self, at least for me. And I find that because I feel embraced, now I'm actually more sensitive to any moment that feels off, and I can quickly pinpoint the humor there. Whereas before, when you don't feel like you have people that are going to care about you, no matter how bad you look or no matter how bad you bomb a joke, then it's very scary and you can fall. You can fall off that tightrope into an abyss where nothing really is funny and you're just upset and you just are hurt by the expectations you failed to meet. And I just find that it is like the embrace of other people that helps me fill my cup of self-love high enough that I can then just make jokes about everything else I'm seeing. And it doesn't have to be like, God, I feel like if I was in a terrible mood, then it's like, how could I write about anything but self-deprecating humor? Because all I'm going to be thinking about is like, what's wrong with me? You know, anxiety is very selfish. Who tweeted that? Somebody tweeted that. But like, God, why are you thinking about yourself so much? It's not about that. That's not how life is meant to go. And that's not what life is about. So I think when I'm in a community where I'm really loved and when I'm with people that I love, I can turn the volume of like self-criticism and just even like self-awareness. Well, self-awareness, self-conscientiousness, that's the right term. Self-awareness, I think, is linguistically has the connotation of like embrace and awareness that helps you move through the world with grace in a better way. Whereas, you know, self-hatred, that has a terrible mental health association and connotation. I think self-consciousness is the perfect word to describe what I'm getting at. And the self-consciousness of always figuring out like, am I saying the right thing? Am I doing the right thing? Are people looking at me weird? Whatever. The volume of it goes so much lower when you're with people that you love. And for me, when I'm with people that are funny too, like when they're telling jokes, I want to hear those jokes. I don't want to hear my own internal monologue. So I think being in community with people has allowed me to just really like turn it down so that when the funny moments come, I can hear that humor and exist in the context of like why it's particularly funny instead of just, you know, digging into my like self-deprecation to find something worth yapping to other people, you know?
Genius answer. I have no follow-ups for you.
I'm just gonna
feel so fulfilled.
Okay, me too. Okay.
Me three.
Yay.
This is coming out on spring break. Okay.
And okay. Period.
During spring break.
During spring break.
What does that mean? On spring.
On this. Yeah.
Get your prepositions right, ho.
And in the last two episodes ago, I was pretty down on spring break. So I'm wondering, just can you give us an optimistic view?
Why would you
view
be down on spring break?
It's a whole thing. It's not
Thank
down.
You,
I'm just setting my expectations lower so that I'm not disappointed.
Okay. Wait, set them low. I think, you know, it's part of the school year. It's just a necessary break. I hope that, like, everybody takes at least, you know, a day of spring break to not think about Yale. And that's the whole point of spring break. I mean, it's hard because I know that everybody, like, I don't know. Spring break, I haven't always, this is the first spring break where I'm like, I'm trying to remember, see if this is correct. No, this is only the second. Okay. God. Restart. Okay. Oh, thank you for that question. The spring break, I believe to be epic, and I think it's a necessary opportunity for people to forget for 1 second that they're Yale students, and I hope everybody has that privilege during spring break, and that's what I'm most excited for, is to go back into the world and realize I'm just a person. I'm not just a Yale student. I'm actually a person, and that's all I need to be.
I adore you.
Same. I love it.
I adore you guys. Seriously, this is like such a treat and an honor.
Have you ever been on a podcast before?
No.
You should do it more.
You could have. I was thinking.
Wait,
you could
I low-key had a dream that I was going to do a podcast. Hence, I put all these things up. But they don't work, by the way. And second of all, I never had a podcast. But I talked with a friend. You know, I had a lot of failed dreams. And I look around this room and they're all here to remind me and inspire me for my next dream.
Yay.
Whatever that may be.
To be honest, I feel like you sound, out of the seniors I've talked to, arguably like the most, like, grounded in, like, I like what Yale has taught me, and I'm accepting, like,
really?
Uncertainty
Period.
Of next year. I think that's what I'm trying to get at.
Well, it's going to be very uncertain, so better accept it. Or, I mean, honestly, I want it to be uncertain. The life I want to have when I'm 40 requires uncertainty now at 23 upon graduation, so I have to embrace it, or else I'll die.
What is that? Can I ask what that life is at 40?
I don't know, but okay, I see what it is.
And
basically, the life at 40 is like I can work for myself, and that's something that I'll work under other people, but where I can work for myself and go to work, and my goal is the day's goal. That's the life I want at 40, and in terms of career. So that requires a lot of career uncertainty at this juncture, and I can't help but embrace, because otherwise I would be extremely anxious and depressed, and I just fired my therapist, so this is not a good time for that.
Okay, everyone take Ben's wise words. That's it.
Boom.
Boom.
All right.
What with that?
So how does this go?
Okay, we're going to do an outro. You can say bye now if you want.
Yeah,
though.
You can say goodbye.
But you can stay on the Zoom. Yeah.
Thank you so much, you guys.
Go follow Ben Jenkins on Instagram so he can have 10,000 plus one bot.
Exactly. At Ben Jenkins. Come see me. Come hang out.
Wait, I was wondering how you say that, actually. Ben Jenkins.
People literally thought my name was like Ben Jen. My name was Benjen Kingsta. And I kind of like that. Yes. If I ever started like a band.
Okay.
Benjen Kingsta.
Heard it here first.
That could be the third project.
It's Ben Jenkins to like Instagram.
Yeah, that's no, I always thought it was so clever, but I was like, how do you pronounce that?
Okay.
But now it makes sense. Okay,
go with that.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for having me. This was really a treat. Okay, sorry I interrupted Jude again. But really, thank you guys for having me. Such a treat. And this was a blast.
Thank
Mike,
you.
Cut.
And with that, thank you all so much for listening. We will see you next Sunday.
Love you.
Bye.
Bye.